I'm Brad Bevan, and I'm the course leader of the Naval History course. And my research focuses on the naval history and popular culture in the 19th century. Today we're going to discuss maritime history and what is maritime history and naval history. And with me, I've got four colleagues, Louise Moon, Matthias Seiter, and James Thomas.
I'm Stephen Gray. I am leading the academic side of the Naval Masters, and I look at Navy and Empire, particularly in the late 19th century, and I also look at fueling networks, so looking at coaling and steamships.
I'm Louise Mean, and my research looks at sailor town and sailors in naval ports, and specifically looking at their socio and cultural lives ashore.
I'm James Thomas, I'm reader in local and maritime history. My research focuses on three issues: Portsmouth's relationship with the Navy between 1650 and 1815, the 18th century provincial impact of the East India Company, and the role and activities of outlaws at sea between 1600 and 1850.
Okay, we heard a little bit about your research interests, but what I really want to discuss in the next 10-15 minutes is what is maritime history? Concept does it entail? And I think you can bring in your own research, obviously, as you talk about it. But and we'll move on to other perhaps discussions of naval history from there.
I think maritime history probably in the last 10 or 20 years or so has transformed completely from maybe more of a focus on a ship at sea into looking at the wider context of the sea, thinking about the sea as a space in itself that needs to be understood, but also as something that links bits of land. So in my own research, I look at the networks which are formed by the Navy across the empire. So I look at a lot of imperial history, which sort of assumes that people just arrive in India, for example, whereas what I'm thinking about is, well, how do they get there? What is needed to get them there? So I think maritime history helps us link those global histories by showing that actually you have to move across the sea, and there are linkages there that are really important.
You're saying it changed. I mean, changed from what to this new idea? What was it changing from?
I think that I think it could be quite inward-looking, and you could get a history of the fishing industry or a history of the Navy, which looked at itself but didn't look necessarily beyond that. So obviously the Navy has relationships with maritime trade, but it also it has relationships with port towns, it has relationships with the state, it has relationships with empire, with popular culture. So there's lots of different parts of history beyond what we might term maritime history, which it interacts with. And I think more recently, that's what we've been looking at. How do these things connect?
Mm. So maritime history can be perceived as a subset of history which demonstrates the sort of imperial networks, trading networks, and social and cultural networks between ports as well, in that sense.
But it's also, in a broader sense, the general impact of the sea on economic, social and cultural developments. And the big changes, I think, have taken place since 1986, when we've moved away from the idea of staggering leaders and outstanding battles, to actually get people to think about, well, how do you assemble a fleet of that proportion? How do you get it to position it? How do you recruit? What impact does that have on an urban or a rural community? How do you feed them? How do you pay them? So I think we now have more pieces of the jigsaw.
Mm. Yes, I mean, I think it follows in from what Stephen was saying, that in that sense that maritime history and many other issues, I guess, of Britain in the first part of the 20th century were quite compartmentalised, quite sort of narrow in their aims and objective. And what you're describing there is an approach to maritime history which is more expansive in a sense, and looking at wider social and cultural.
And in my view, it changes with the publication of one book in 1986 by Nicholas Roger called The Wooden World, the anatomy of the Georgian Navy, which made people think about some of the key dynamics that went into maritime and naval life, which was good.
Yeah, absolutely. And it moves away from that sort of hero worshipping of individuals.
Yes. Very much so.
Although valuable those works were, given the sense of leadership and aspect, it doesn't tell the whole story.
No. It focused in some ways quite wrongly, because some of the early material was actually a little short of hagiographical.
And I think that's the thing you need to be aware of when you're reading this material. It's quite significant.
I think also in addition to as James just said, I think this whole idea of in maritime history as a place of encounter, encounters both of port communities and sailors, but also of nations, kind of, I think is quite a powerful idea to take maritime history further. It's not something which is completely national in a sense. Always. We have, for example, visits of the Royal Navy to German naval ports. We have sailors meeting in ports around the world and interacting with each other. So I think maritime history has the potential to really show how cultures and social groups met, how these interactions happened, and also how the space around them was shaped.
It's interesting, so in terms of British and German navies, as you mentioned, that the only time we often think about them meeting is in a battlefield or in a sort of battleship at sea, and so your research suggests differently, doesn't it?
Well, I find it quite interesting that yes, we talk about Anglo-German relationship mostly about the arms race, the naval arms race, but what we have, for example, is in June 1914, right at the eve of the First World War, the Royal Navy visiting the Imperial Navy in Kiel for the Kiel Week, and actually both navies were at the same place when the news of the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand came. So it is, and up to this point, both sides actually engaged quite frankly with each other. Sailors were working in mixed groups through the streets. They competed in sporting events, and British sailors were received quite positively and quite friendly by the local population. So it's this richness which goes beyond battles, beyond wartime histories, and shows, in a sense, a normality of encounters.
So maritime history, as you all see it so far, is something which is quite sort of inclusive in terms of its...
I think as a concept as well, maritime history is changing as we sit here today, in the sense that particularly from my own research, looking at sailor towns in navy ports and sailors' lives ashore, maritime history is coming ashore, and the divide between the sort of green and blue histories, if you like, it is lessening, and I think that's a really important change that's happening off the back of the cultural turn, particularly the cultural turn of naval history, but moving away from that economic and labour approaches and looking at everything that Matthias was saying about these places of exchanges. But I think the really key thing, particularly for my own research, is that maritime history can be done from shore, and it can come ashore, and I think that's a really key thing for us to remember.
And Luke, could you say a little bit more about your research? I think that's quite an interesting idea of having this idea of maritime history coming ashore.
So my research looked at maritime communities, essentially, and that specifically naval sailors in the port of Portsmouth. And what's fundamental is that they're always seen as peripheral to the sort of landed history and the integration with the urban development and the growth of Portsmouth, for example, as an urban centre. And actually my research showed through tracking them through things like census records, trade directories, there was a huge land-based network that sailors had, which complemented, wasn't necessarily in competition with, the ship-based networks that they had with their fellow workers, And when they came back to Shore, some of those networks were replicated, but they also had ones within the wider community. And in that sense, they brought aspects of maritime culture and experience onto the land, which in turn infiltrated through, for example, Sabertown communities. So in things like maritime superstition, in terms of culture, and there's been lots of work done by the Port Towns Group on that. And I think that's just the really key thing, is that maritime history can, and indeed does, penetrate onto land. It's not just something that belongs to the ship or the sea alone.
And I think that, that goes much beyond in lots of different ways, because you have a lot of histories of the involvement of the state and the navy. So, as James was saying earlier, you have to feed the navy. So where is the food coming from? Where is the timber coming from for the ships? Where is the material for the sail? So actually these networks go massively inland. You know, they're hugely land-based networks. Obviously it's governed from London. It's protecting business interests and trade, which is from London, but also around the world. And it's cultural impact as well. So, you see the famous Navy Cut cigarettes, which you could buy all over Britain. So the culture of the Navy goes beyond just looking at a shoreline. So I think you're absolutely right in that way, that we have to consider maritime history beyond just a shoreline and the sea. And in fact, it links lots of different types of history, cultural, social, but economic history in new and different ways. So I think it's quite difficult to draw a line where maritime history stops because it influences all these different
things. I think it's impossible to draw a line because there are so many links and connections. I mean, if you take the point about cultural contact, virtually every vessel afloat, with a few exceptions in the 18th century at least, were examples of floating polyglot societies. An English merchant craft would not have a crew composed entirely of Englishmen. So you've got the whole question of how you issue orders. I think when it comes ashore, you've got the interesting dimension of the development, for example, of an early allotment system. So you hand over part of your pay, your wife and children, so you can track financial records and look at the links between the development of maritime life and the development of provincial banking. And I think to pick up on Stephen's point about the economic impact, every naval town up to 40 miles away from it, the practice of farming and arboriculture was affected by naval demands for food and timber. So they're creating an awful lot of business, which provides an awful lot of people with opportunities to get rich.
So just to pick up on what James has said, but also Luther said, I think this idea of naval or maritime history is something which can go beyond and push boundaries of research is quite interesting. If we look, for example, kind of this dualism of, on one hand, a navy being something fiercely national, but on the other hand, because the navy has to go to places and isn't stationed at home, it has a very international element. So we have, in a sense, it pushes the boundary of national history writing and adds another complexity to it. As James has said, naval ships, merchant ships, were not exclusively by center for more nationality necessarily. For example, probably most famously, Nelson's crew at the Battle of Trafalgar wasn't only comprised of English men, there were also Germans and Swedes kind of fighting there. But also, for example, when ships sailed around the world, they had to dock at other ports where they met other cultures, but also where they kind of encounter foreign things. Things foreign to them, and it's kind of, it dilutes the clear boundaries between national history and transnational history, and I think that is one of the strengths that forces us to look beyond the shores of a nation.
If you want classic examples of that, a lot of East Indiamen, when they reached India, because of either desertion, illness, or death, they would have to take on board Lascar sailors and help them bring the ships back. This led to the development, in particular in London, of proper Lascar communities with their observance of their religious festivals and that sort of thing. So it gave people a chance to meet people from the other side of the world, both, as Messiah said, in the overseas port town, but also in this country. And then these people, having done their duty for the company, were repatriated to India free of charge. But it did mean that at certain stages in the 18th century, you could walk down the high street in Old Port and find it very difficult to hear English being actually being spoken.
So the international dimension.
Very much so. With astute businessmen earning a living, acting as interpreters and translators for these foreign sailors. And jewellers and silversmiths providing money so that when people went to wherever they were going, they had money at their disposal.
I mean, what we're saying here, essentially, maritime history is quite international dimension. It's a narrow type of sub-discipline of history, and it incorporates aspects on land as well.
Yes.
So far, we've talked a little bit about the Navy, but often historians call themselves naval historians, maritime historians. And can we work through those differences? Is there a difference between naval and maritime history?
There is, I think, one difference. A naval historian primarily is looking at people who were employed by the state, usually to defend and protect its interests from the time of, say, Oliver Cromwell onwards. Maritime historians tend to look more at people who are non-naval, in other words, people working aboard merchantmen, whalers, fishing vessels, that sort of thing. Now, that's not to say there isn't a crossover between the two, because when you look at things like how the Navy obtained its manpower, a lot of that was obtained by pressing men from the merchant service.
And certainly, and when we look at, we've just been discussing maritime history, we've been talking a very broad approach and how to try not to compartmentalise. Would you say the same should be your approach to naval history? In the sense that...
Yeah.
I mean, I think what James says about the crossover is an interesting one. I mean, I primarily look at the navies, but you ignore the merchant fleet at your peril, really, because, you know, when we talk about 19th century empire, it's, you know, people have argued that it is all about trade. You know, it's not about taking territory, it's about making money through the City of London. And it is business interests that are running the empire, essentially. And to understand the Navy, you have to understand that. So you have to understand that the Navy is protecting these trade routes rather than the bits coloured pink on a map. Mm. So I think if you ignore the maritime element of it, then you are missing the point, essentially. You don't understand what the Navy is for. And, you know, I think possibly now that we are sort of isolated from the maritime elements of Britain, much more than we would have been, say, 100 years ago.
Why do you say that?
I think people don't realise how much we still rely on the sea. It's something like 90% of everything that you own has come here by sea. Yet, unless you live on the south coast, you wouldn't necessarily know that. You know, you just see the train bringing it across, maybe, you know, with the crate on the back. But I don't think there's necessarily an understanding of the importance of the sea still.
And that, you think we'd argue that was that importance was known 100 years ago. The significance of the sea in people's lives.
I think if you look at popular culture, I mean, the classic Rule Britannia is a great example of how, you know, people saw an island nation, and by definition, one that was powerful because of the sea.
And I think it was more evident too, in the sense that we had a large navy and a large mercantile marine, which was very labour intensive. So it was quite common in the run up World War I for 8,000 men to come ashore at night here in Portsmouth. And the presence of all of these people was much more visible then, 100 years ago, and even more so 200 years ago. Most people knew somebody who had a member of the family who was in one or other maritime branch, as it were, whether it was navy or merchant or was off on a whaler or whatever.
And I think that also has implications for maritime and naval history in terms of heritage. Mm. because there is this sense of removal. For example, people don't necessarily know people that are serving in either the merchant service or indeed the Navy itself. But the fact that you, while sailors do still come ashore, the impact and the sort of the shockwave that could send through a sailor town or port community, that effect isn't really the same anymore. And it also links into the decline of shipbuilding, that people aren't growing up seeing ships being built in docks per se anymore. And currently working in a heritage environment as well, you see that particularly with younger children that don't understand the sort of Navy's place in the world because it's behind these walled sections of the dockyard, and they just come to visit it as an attraction without necessarily realising that there's this sort of wealth of history and heritage behind it. So as well as history, I think it's also important that, particularly for us as historians, that we think about the messages that we're passing on to future generations as well, particularly
I suppose in some ways it's about impact and size. I mean, when the supercarriers arrive here, for example, I strongly suspect there'll be a great turnout of people who are interested. Same as there was a great turnout when the ships left for the Falklands Task Force, and the seafront was awash with people. But if you think back, when there was an absence of mass social media, people tended to turn out much more. For these events. I mean, thinking today, anniversary of the glorious 1st of June, and Howe's victorious return with French prize ships led to thousands of people coming to Portsmouth because they wanted to see these vessels, they wanted to see these despicable French people, they wanted to taunt them, they wanted to say to them, well, so much for your revolution hasn't done you any good. And I think it's that media interest which we take for granted now, because you can just switch on the telly and watch it.
Become a lot more public
spectacle,
in that sense.
And as it becomes more public, we become more remote. I mean, when the 1977 Silver Jubilee Fleet Review took place, there was a great fear here that thousands of people would descend by train, including some of London's leading prostitutes, for example. And there was lots and lots of money to be made. What they failed to realise was that most people would watch the review from their armchair on the television.
Which, I suppose, think about, that was the first major review in broadcasting.
Since Coronation Review of the 1950s.
So most people didn't have it. Well, I think it was just about that.
I think one aspect also is how people used to visit warships when they were aboard. Right. I mean, when it's quite common when a naval ship visited a foreign port was for example, when a German Navy vessel went to Sydney or Perth for a refit, visitors, locals, would basically be allowed on the ship to inspect the ship and have a look around. And it's kind of this level of engagement with the public. And kind of is quite interesting. It shows the centrality of the Navy in public imagination. Kind of Germans, when the Royal Navy visited Kiel in 1940, the German public was interested in how these British dreadnoughts look like. How do they compare? And it's quite common for civilians to tour these ships. One additional point I just want to make also in terms of the significance or the past significance and the decline of significance of at least the awareness of the Navy in the public imagination is obviously ships used to be the mode of transport for long distance transport. So people were aware of the importance of the Navy. It was always a topic of, you know, kind of the Navy as a means to protect these routes of transport. Migrants, immigrants, but empire itself relied on ships to connect these different parts of route. Things which are now served by the aeroplane, distances which are now covered in hours, more than days. But if we look at right up until the 1950s, 60s, the role kind of
ships played in public life.
And also in terms of military, the way the wars were conducted as well. I think there's an awareness, you know, when Britain was a great power, its power rested on the fact that it had a powerful navy, so it could control the sea. If it can control the sea, it can control trade, which was the lifeblood of the empire of the nation. So Britain's success was built on control of the sea. Once you have aeroplanes, it's a very different dynamic.
But also kind of just to get troops across.
Mm.
If Southampton, for example, has seen troops leaving for the continent, going back to the times of Agincourt.
Yeah.
And so there's a continuity kind of ships, of troops leaving.
That leads me really nicely, I think, to the next question, really, which is that, you know, we're talking about how maritime history, naval history, or naval presence in society was not more visible 100, 200 years ago. Now, given that it's less visible now, where do you see the future of maritime naval history going?
I think it will continue to ask searching questions to which we don't yet have the answers. And I think although we're seeing a reduced-sized navy, and we're seeing a reduced-sized merchant marine, it will not stop people asking those pertinent questions. So I don't see there being an end to it, in the sense that the more you probe, the more we need to probe. I mean, more recently there's been the whole question of just how many women were serving in the navy in the 18th century. How many women were serving in the merchant marine? And the fact that there were women present at Trafalgar, and there was at least one woman present at the Glorious 1st of June. That sort of thing. I think we still have more questions than we have answers, which is a good thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it would become more of a sort of magpie and take ideas from other areas of history. I mean, the area that I work in, looking at navy and empire, I think there's huge questions still about the navy's role in empire, the navy's role with interactions with other races and people, their role of sharing ideas about empire. So people's impressions at home were often shaped by what the navy brought back, or, you know, the stories they told, the pictures, the photographs that they come back with. So that was someone's connection with the empire. So I think those sorts of questions are things that haven't necessarily been looked at. And also, we were talking, you know, we've moved away from looking at, say, just Nelson and, you know, the great admirals. And I think this more sort of everyday understanding of the Navy and the Navy's role is a direction that we need to go in. Mm-hmm. And understanding that, you know, battles are, you know, small events in long lines of peace.
Well, why is that important? Why is the everyday naval history important?
I think it's important to understand how the whole complex process of machinery, whether it applied to the navy or to the merchant marine, how it actually functioned. If you wanted to dispatch a squadron, say, from Southampton or from here, in the event at the time of the Crimean War, exactly what went in to making sure everything was ready at the right time. How did these thousands of people move from being thousands of individuals to one cohesive body that was able to follow commands? And how did it work? And it was extremely difficult to work when ships were sail-bound. How did it work seemingly to clockwork?
I think also kind of, I think it has relevance because we are, as always talked, that we are living in a very complex time. But I think the study of maritime history and the Navy, especially the places where the Navy meets the land or the maritime culture meets the land, are actually interesting case studies of very complex spaces. We have spaces where we have sailors from different backgrounds, both social but also national foreign sailors. We have kind of sailors from the Navy, kind of the land. But we also have on land, we have businessmen, we have prostitutes, we have pub owners, but on the other hand, we have the church or the local authorities, who all are concerned. We're very confined in small space, and we have all these people meeting there and mixing there. And it shows an interest in complexity, which I think can help us to understand complexities of today's society.
But I also think it gives back many of these individuals their identity for a very long time, naval history, and its approach, particularly to sailors of the lower deck, have been simply as a manning problem. And whilst that's quite right if you're looking at the Navy as a strategic entity, but actually these were fundamentally human beings, just like everyone else. And by going back and looking at them as individuals and looking at their complex lives, both ashore and you're actually giving them back a sense of identity that very often gets sort of vacuumed under this vast naval hierarchy. But more importantly, for the future and for the work we do as historians and also for heritage organisations as well, it's those individual stories and understandings that makes the past relatable, and it opens up accessibility. And so whilst academics could be seen as remote, actually by looking at individual case studies, by explaining how things are similar to perhaps the world that we live in now and giving back that sense of identity to individuals and to families and communities, it actually creates an avenue to self-sustain maritime and naval history and take it in new directions.
I think the importance of the ordinary sailor as well is the fact that there's so many of them. And, you know, we're talking about, when we talk about Nelson or Collingwood, we're talking about exceptional people. We're not talking about the life of, you know, the tens of thousands of sailors that serve underneath them. And it gives you a skewed picture of the Navy, but also of, you know, the life of an average seafarer. So I think it's really important that we put that perspective in there, really. And I think people forget that the Navy is a huge, almost industrial, sector, really, that employs tens of thousands of people. So it's not an insignificant sideline of British history. It is a very, very important part.
And should be locked into mainstream history in that sense.
Absolutely.
And I think many people forget that it was, in fact, the biggest industry in this country.
And then, what time are we talking about now?
Certainly in the 18th century, and in many respects, the first 30 years of the 19th century. I mean, if you look at dockyard complexes, they were the biggest industrial organisations and establishments you could find in this country. It wasn't about dark satanic mills. It was about the ability to get 2,000 or 3,000 men into a confined space and get them all to start work at the same time, just by ringing a bell.
So what I think we're saying here is that, you know, the crucial thing about exploring maritime naval history is to ensure that we don't take a narrow compartmentalised view. By not doing that, we actually show the significance of maritime and naval history. The huge significance, as James was saying, and Stephen, particularly on the size of the Navy through much of the Northern period.
I think if we move away from battles and wars as well, we begin to understand more about what the Navy is for. I think people now work in the 19th century, where people often say, well, nothing happened. And it completely underestimates, in terms of, you know, geopolitics, the deterrence of having warships. Governments don't spend money for the sake of spending money. So there must be a reason why they sustain the Navy. And the reason is, you know, if you can shadow a Russian ship around the Cape of Good Hope, then the Russian Navy think, well, we better not pick a fight on British interests, because the British Navy can get to us. And also, you know, if you turn up with an enormous state-of-the-art warship in somewhere like Bombay, then the people of Bombay think, wow, you know, that is a cultural symbol of power. That is, you know, the British power, what they can bring if we, you know, anyway disagree with them. So I think we underestimate what the Navy was doing, both in the sort of protection of trade, but also in a cultural sense, by only concentrating on the bits of war, which are sporadic, by the nature of warfare.
I think by focusing on the peacetime, this connection between the Navy and the land, becomes even more becomes clearer, because all these sailors were connected to families who were living on the land, and that also kind of influenced and or had an influence on the land around, kind of where these people lived. So there is a clear relationship between everyday life and why the national history. If we look at Britain, for example, I think that is one of the real strength of the subject.
A connection becomes apparent too, I think, in a way that has been looked at by some historians, but is worthy of more exploration. That is, after, say, 1653, roughly, it becomes obvious that naval and merchant officers are having more of a say in national affairs. If you look at the composition of the House of Commons, for example, there are more naval officers and more merchant officers sitting in Parliament. They end up forming blocks of interests. And certainly when Cromwell was protector, he listened to what those merchant and naval interests had to say. And I think that was of vital importance.
So we need to show those connections,
yes,
that go beyond the ports.
Yes, yes, it's really about a series of overlapping spheres, because one of the elements we haven't talked about, but which Matthias hinted at in terms of connections, is one of the things that comes back to this country, and it's not as laughable as it may sound, is a large number of botanical specimens, which are brought back by sailors and merchant crew. These people need instruments through which to operate their vessels, which leads to the development of a whole sub-industry of mathematical and precision instrument makers based in London and in key port towns. You have specialist booksellers, and it just himself perpetuating.
I think the role in science we often forget as well. Mm. So, you know, astronomy, the transit of Venus famously, what goes to investigate, but, you know, maybe that's not his primary reason, but, you know, that's what the Navy are doing at that time. They're producing charts, you know, they're at the forefront of working out how to navigate. They're at the forefront of, as you say, botanical specimens. The weather forecast is, you know, from developments within ships. So I think, you know, we forget our peril, the important national role that they're playing in science, but also in geography, geology, and things like that.
Thank you, Arthur. We've been talking about the Navy. What parts of society did they rely upon for manning?
Right. They relied, first of all, on those people who volunteered. And if you look at the wording and volunteering and advertisements, they differ between periods of peace and periods of war. But because there was no Royal Naval Reserve until the middle of the 19th century, they looked to collier crewmen and whaler crewmen and people who served in the East India Company's marine branch. And the idea was the attempt to press these people into service. Now, collier crewmen and whalemen were extremely hardened. And one of the pieces of evidence that we have for the depth of their activities is in the 18th century, the coal trade is centred on Newcastle. In the 19th century, it's more centred on Wales. But in the 18th century, you find pubs at the end of the chain of coal delivery in places like Portsmouth and Gosport. You find local inns with names associated with the coaling trade, like the Sunderland Pink, the North Country Ship, that sort of thing. And communities, port town communities, dreaded the arrival of these ships because these hardened people believed in interpersonal violence.
Mm. It goes beyond that as well. In Malta, you find Newcastle Street and Liverpool Street and Cardiff Row or whatever. And they have coaling, sort of where the collier crews went, the pubs. Even sailors wouldn't go in names because they were well known for fighting and alcohol abuse.
Yeah,
that's a more recent term for it.
Yeah. Something to do with the local level of illegitimacy.
Mm. I think those are good examples how the sea and how navy shaped mm-hmm. the urban environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at naval pub towns here,
yes,
Nelson, Victory, all these names that's the crop up in the last.
Which also goes to say something about the cultural impact of the name.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about, well, Nelson's Column in the London, one of the most famous landmarks, you know, is a naval man. Mm-hmm. And yeah, as you say, lots of pubs, even in places not like Portsmouth, named after ships, named after ports that they used to go into. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it goes beyond just a simple, you know, ships on the water, but that's a cultural impact mm-hmm. of, you know, the thousands of mugs with Nelson's head on.
Or if we talk about the quintessential item for every young boy to sailor suit. Mm-hmm. It's and how kind of this shows.
That's transnational, it goes.
It's transnational.
From the royal family downwards, the pictures of.
I think the royal family probably would you say the royal family were the main instigators across Europe having their boys in sailor suits.
I think it also permeates wider because, for example, much of the modern day slang that we use in our everyday talk originates from Jack's Beak. Sailor slang, and
yeah.
a lot of people have lost that connection and understanding where that's come from. So it's not just the physical either, it's also the more sort of intangible sort of cultural heritage that gets passed on as well.
Good from the gingerbread.
From our discussion, it seems that maritime and naval history has a bright future, and I think that as long as we keep challenging those boundaries and thinking about naval and maritime history in a different way, so how it can be connected to other sub-disciplines of history and different aspects of society. I think it's got a lot more research within that area.